So, hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming all over the world on the World Wide Web, www.kpfk.org. We know that we have listeners all over the country, which is really terrific, and it means a whole lot that you're listening to us on the web. Today I'm going to have a friend of mine on. That's how I start thinking about Gary. His name is Gary Stewart, and he's sort of a radical man about town. He's worked for Rhino Records and helped to initiate Rhino in many, many ways. He worked for iTunes, and he has some ideas now about popularizing films. So he and I do a lot of talk about both music and film revolution and the intersection of that. And we're going to bring you in. But we're going to talk about some of our favorite films this year, why we think they're good. You should get ready. 818-985-5735. We'll go to the phones around 3:40. If Gary and I get boring, we'll go earlier. If we think we're so fascinating, we'll forget about you. But whatever happens, I'm in studio with Gary Stewart. And Gary is a truly interesting guy because he is very close to social movements. He is starting a business called, is it going to be called In My Trunk? From My
It's called Trunkworthy.
Trunkworthy. Besides the many things he does, he carries around DVDs and CDs in his trunk, lots of them. But I'm not going to give you the license number. And then when he goes to movement groups, he opens up the trunk, and there are these, like, the first four seasons of The Wire, or a terrific box set on Louisiana music a la Tremé. So he's sort of friend to the movement, part of the movement. He serves on the Liberty Hill board. He worked for iTunes, I told you that. So we're just going to have him on, and me and Gary are just going to be here, and you can listen. And we're going to start talking about films in 2013, and who knows where we'll go from there.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad that somehow my opining can be of some value.
Sure, at least
we'll see if it is.
Well, I think you'll irritate a lot of people and raise our ratings.
It's always what I try to do.
So let's start with your top three films of 2013.
Top three films of 2013. Well, number one for me is a film called Stories We Tell by a Canadian actress named Sarah Polley, who you've seen in a few films like The Sweet Hereafter and some bigger budget films, some art films. She also directed Julie Christie to an Oscar nomination in a film called Away from Her about Alzheimer's. She's also an activist, by the way, so nice to work that in. She made a film about her family history and something she discovered in her family history that surprised her. It changed her own narrative, her own understanding, brought about a bit of a early life crisis in her and her family. But the film goes in a different direction. It also becomes about storytelling and who gets to tell a story and who gets to own a narrative and who needs that narrative. So it's so much more than just a documentary. I'm very sad to see it passed up for, I would have loved to see it get a Best Picture nomination, but at least a Best Documentary nomination. I think it was shortlisted or it was close to that. It got a lot of good reviews, attentions at film festivals. It's very watchable. It's not a spinach film. It's not good for you. It's a very personal story, and it's a documentary in the loosest sense of the word. It has a political context. I think everything that you do, that you and I talk about, is really about telling our story, and it has a very personal context as well.
Well, let me ask you this. Tell me the name of the film again.
It's called Stories We Tell.
Well, that should be easy, but question, is it playing right now in L.A.?
It is not playing in L.A., but it's on DVD. And by the way, it dotted a lot of top 10 lists, dotted a lot of critics' lists.
So here's a problem for me that happens. This is I would like to see just about every film at the New Art, every film at the Music Hall. When I see the coming attractions, I go, want to see that one. But they go very quickly, you know, most of them inside of the small theaters. And then they don't get to Netflix for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So I know that's one of the things that you're trying to figure out with your fledgling idea. But, like, That film's on DVD, but how would our listeners even know that Stories We Tell? Could we get 100 people to get it, as an example? How do you even get it?
Well, I don't know the particulars, but I'm pretty sure it's probably available on Amazon, on iTunes, any place that sells DVDs would be my guess, and maybe even through one of the Netflix services. But it is widely available, because that's what happens to a film 6 months after it's released commercially. It gets, or 3 months sometimes, the blockbusters gets made available sometimes through on-demand or sometimes through DVD. But that's the point of what we're trying to do is, things come and go so quickly, especially smaller films get a 1 to 2 to 3, maybe 4 week window. And even if they're well reviewed or raved about, like this film was, they have a very short life, because we're in such a sort of accelerating zeitgeist culture, and everything is, you know, reviewed usually at three and a half star, 7 out of 10 level, talked about, consumed, and then almost, abandoned. Till it's either lucky enough to make it onto a top 10 list, or somebody that's crazy like me drags it out of my trunk or talks it up, or, you know, uses the chatter of the net or social media to give it a second life. I mean, look, that was done for a film like The Big Lebowski. It was done for a band like Big Star. It's a tradition that I'm hoping to continue.
Well, I just TiVo'd The Big Lebowski, so I'm really excited about seeing that. Go to your second film that you like a lot.
I really loved Inside Llewyn Davis. The Coen Brothers movie about the Greenwich Village folk scene, and it didn't get an Oscar nomination. People were surprised. I think a lot of people I've talked to didn't like the film, or felt it was too bleak, or were kind of hoping for something else. We're hoping for maybe more of what they perceive as the lunacy of the Coen Brothers, which I think is a mixed perception if you've been watching any recent films of theirs, like No Country for Old Men or A Serious Man. Or they were looking for something exciting to kind of take you back to the glory days of folk music. And this just uses that world as a setting. I think the film's about two things. It's about the sort of marginal life that an artist has if they don't happen to be at the center of popularity or buzz, which the artist in Inside, which Llewyn Davis is in that film, great performance by Oscar Isaac. It could have been about the punk scene. It could have been about the beat poets. But it's also about somebody kind of bumping up against, you know, the maze of the universe and it not really working for him entirely. And without sounding too pretentious, a bit of an existential journey movie like A Serious Man. And I think if you see it through that prism, it's entertaining without being, you know, fun and exciting. I've seen it twice because there was so much to take in. And it's, you know, it's an entertaining, involving film that's, again, not like a serving of spinach. And I think a lot of people miss the boat on that one.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's going on, you're listening to Gary Stewart, and this is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontline. We're talking about films and political films. Particular film I liked was Her. I liked it a lot. I like Spike Jones. I like Intentionality. My wife, Leon, certainly didn't like the first hour. Without going into details, you know, I think everybody knows that it's about, what's the name of the actor?
Joaquin Phoenix's character.
So Joaquin Phoenix's character is a very lonely guy who gets hooked on an operating system. And the operating system is, I guess, like the genie inside your cell phone, which I don't use yet. But what happens is that this is such an advanced form of technology that she is able to mimic emotion and react to emotion. Essentially, she starts out with no emotional, she being Scarlett Johansson, who is, I think, does a terrific job as the voice of the operating system. And over time, they build a relationship, and they fall in love with each other. And I think Joaquin Phoenix is so vulnerable in the film. I mean, his hysteria at being so happy and not realizing that what he's happy about is pure, unadulterated narcissism, that the operating system gives him everything he wants, tells him everything. It tells him he's funny, tells him if he's sad, it's sort of like she could be the wife. If he's sexy, she could be the lover. If he's depressed, she could be the psychiatrist, all wrapped up in one, which is what every man dreams of. And then says, gee, my wife let me down. You know, I'm so disappointed she didn't achieve all those things. So, again, without doing so-called spoiler alert, the crisis that he goes through from the original ecstasy is very fascinating and is a real rite of passage for him. And the idea that in the end, I will tell you this, he didn't shoot his mother. That was a different film. In the end, he realizes that he has to have human relationships. And that experience forced him back into understanding that if there was anything good in life, it's to be with a real human being. And then the last thing is, I'm very, very scared about the iPhone culture and the, you know, the whole electronic culture, in the way that I'm very afraid that people are not turning out to be real people. That, again, the narcissism of texts and of emails and of always looking and always playing with it is almost like you have to interrupt their relationship with their phone to talk to you, which is actually one of the scenes in the film that's pretty funny.
It's in there. I liked it a lot. It's one of my favorite films of the year, but I have a different interpretation than you. You're right in part. I think what I love about the film is it's not just a anti-technology screed. It explores that point in that film, and this doesn't give away a lot. The operating system does take on a life of its own. She does become a personality. It has some exploration of artificial intelligence in it. It talks about the mechanical and all of us needing to find the human as well on the side of her character. I also like that character is not just this person that could never connect with people. He'd come off a relationship that didn't work out or that he was healing from. He had other people in his life. It wasn't as monochromatic, and I think it was smart. It was looking at many different nooks and crannies of that situation and not saying, let's get rid of technology or it's hurting us. It's saying, here are some of the things we're going to have to take a look at. Here are some of the benefits.
Well, I also think that the scene with Rooney Mara, who's his wife in the show where they are having a divorce and they're choosing to have the divorce at a table, is just another example of when a fine actress can come in and take the screen for 3 minutes and take it over. I forgot it was Rooney Mara for a minute.
Like she did in The Social Network.
Yes.
You know, 3 minutes there.
So, you know, it's really, when you know, the very best ones can theoretically steal the scene. So go see her. You read my review of Wolves of Wall Street. So there's nothing you could say better, but I'm trying to say, is there anything you would like to try to say that could live up to that?
I can't top it, but it's strange. I liked it better than you did, you know, while maybe having some problems with it. Scorsese is just such a great filmmaker in that I noticed about an hour and 40 minutes into that film, I'm just noticing how quick it went and thinking, I'm having a lot of fun. He's, you know, he really keeps things moving. There's great performances and a great energy. Some of the moral problems people had with it and some of the sort of repetition of themes in the third hour did get to me. I don't love the movie. I find it problematic. I think people saying that it glorifies opulence and excess is a mistake. I think it also perhaps falls short in not kind of taking a look at the consequences of these characters. Hopefully this isn't a lazy critique, but it going on for 3 hours, to me, says maybe an hour and 40 minutes or 2 hours worth of showing this lifestyle and then letting you see how unsavory these characters are fine, but if you're going to keep repeating the hedonistic behavior, the sex, and the, you know, the unchecked power, I need something more. I need more context, and I need more consequence. That's my own prejudice as a film goer. I wouldn't defend it. It wouldn't be on my list. But again, like her, there was a little more to it, and I think, you know, your critique was a really deep critique, but a lot of people have just said it glorifies things. I think that's too narrow a criticism. I don't think it's one of the best films of the year either.
Yeah, I don't either, but I want to stay a little bit more with it because I do think it's a very important film, and I enjoyed it immensely. This is Eric Mann. I'm here with Gary Stewart. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Let me ask you this. The thing I felt about, I mean, you mentioned it, I saw Mean Streets. We're talking about Martin Scorsese. I mean, I saw Mean Streets. Nothing but amazing. And the early Robert De Niro was just riveting. I saw Okay, what's the second? The
Taxi Driver?
No, the long, long one about the mafia. It's just
Goodfellas.
Goodfellas. I saw Goodfellas. And it follows a very similar line, which is in Goodfellas, the young guy gets involved. He thinks it's great. He thinks Big Paulie is just great. Everything is going to be wonderful. It's sort of like a, you know, high school kid who sort of knows he's joined the mafia, but thinks it's sort of like rough businessmen or something like that. And then it shows addiction that you're in and you can't get out. And then it shows your own deterioration. And then again, it shows the role of drugs. But here's the thing. In going back to The Wolf of Wall Street, who is the so-called hero? So it can't be, and you're going to help me with all my names, mm-hmm. The football coach on Friday Night
Kyle
Light.
Kyle Chandler, who's the FBI right. agent.
So Kyle Chandler is given to me a lousy part. I mean, he's sort of treated like a tired bureaucrat who, you know, as he says, takes the subway home. He's made not to be sexy. He's made to be unattractive, and the FBI is very unattractive to me. So what I'm getting to is it's not so much that I thought the film glorified greed and glorified drugs, but if Denzel Washington busted into the room right then as the head of a community organization and said, we're demanding that you do 1, 2, and 3 for the community, of course you can't make that film. That's the point, that once the external reality of the world comes in, not just around suffering, but if anybody came in with power, ideology, and action, Leonardo DiCaprio, how would you write his part?
Well, let me take a quick diversion there because you mentioned Goodfellas, and I forgot that that's what I was thinking of during the film is Goodfellas for me was such a great film because it looked at the sort of mythology of violence and mafia culture and the glorification, and then it pulls the rug from under you and saying, oh, you're loving this, you're riding along with these people, and then some really horrible things happen. You went like, oh, yeah, I should be, you know, there's some shame here, there's some embarrassment. And I thought that was the last film he was going to make like that. I thought that, you know, this was his sort of commenting on Mean Streets and commenting on the male archetype and commenting on, you know, the popularization of crime. And, you know, I would like to see more growth. And I found Wolf of Wall Street in many ways repeated that note, but didn't even have the, you know, the ballast of the, you know, the financial crimes. Back to your point, community organizer busting in would be a different movie for me. He made a choice to focus on this one aspect, show it, hope that you would see something like a Rorschach ink block and get something out of it. You know, let's bring in another medium here. If you remember the end of the second season of Sopranos, it ends with a party Tony's having, you know, much like a celebration of the Godfather movies, and it's juxtaposed with the senior center going out of business, or you know, these people I think losing their apartments, all the detritus of his crimes, which you really don't see in the early in the Sopranos. You know he's doing something criminal, but it seems all internal, and you see these you know, the sort of tumbleweeds of the lives that have been marginalized or destroyed. That's the kind of voice that I think might have been a little bit more appropriate in Wolf of Wall Street. But then I didn't make that movie.
You're listening to Gary Stewart and Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines, 818-985-5735. We're going to go to the phones about 4:40 if we get calls to talk about film some more. So let me try again about why,
come
for
at
instance,
me.
Yeah. Like, why David Simon cannot figure out a radical community organizer in either Tremé or in The Wired? Because I go around the country, and so our little map is, you know, you work with Lane, I work with the Labor Community Strategy Center, there's Scope, there's Agenda, there's Community Coalition, there's the Community Rights Campaign. There are the Dreamers. All over the country, there's the Domestic Workers, National Domestic Workers Alliance. In every city, there's now thousands, not millions, I wouldn't even say 10,000s, but thousands of people who are involved in social justice movement work and are damn attractive and damn able to walk into a scene and carry their lines. And I'm arguing that the reason why they keep us out is because just like Rooney Mara, we're going to steal the show. Because, see, if Scorsese keeps you taking in and you're looking at Leonardo DiCaprio, who's so beautiful. I mean, he can, if you're talking about manipulating the screen, I love watching. I could watch, you know, I could watch him brush his teeth for 3 hours.
It's a seduction.
But it's a seduction.
Yeah.
And I know what he's doing. I know I'm being seduced. But then he cheats other people. And most people are thinking, I don't want to be that guy that got cheated. That's a loser. I am Leonardo DiCaprio. Then he tries to get away from the FBI. The listener is saying, I hate the FBI. The FBI is probably with Obama anyway. Or, you know, I don't like the FBI for good reasons. So I still like the criminals. Then, in fact, Scorsese ends with the real Wolf of Wall Street coming in, introducing, just keep giving the names.
What, Jordan Buford?
Yeah, Jordan Buford comes in and introduces Leonardo DiCaprio, as in other words, the real Jordan Buford, who is the crook, who came out of prison, is now going right back on a smaller scale to hustling people. And in the scene, he brings in Leonardo DiCaprio as his example, and Leonardo DiCaprio is doing one of his classic parables. So the point is, maybe the film says people can't change. Maybe the film says whatever. But the film never has an attractive character who says, hey, Leonardo, you're not just wrong, you're a loser. We're having a demonstration today, you know, about rent strikes. We're having music. We're not having orgies. But we are a very exciting movement. We're trying to do something. A screenwriter could write a character like us into the script in a way that would burst the bubble. And I argue that bubble cannot exist without, could only exist because there's no alternative to it shown.
I'd like to see more of that represented, but for me, that's a different film. For me, the film chooses, or a show like The Wire or Tremé, though those are displays or critiques of a problem. They're not examples of a solution. Although I think Tremé ultimately is about the solution. I think Tremé ultimately becomes about the solution to The Wire. The Wire is, I always look at those two shows as, The Wire is about a city that should work, has enough money, infrastructure, smart people, and doesn't because of institutional failure and political attitudes and marginalization. Tremé is about a city that shouldn't work. It's underwater, it doesn't have a lot of money, and it often doesn't, but in the end, food, music, culture, and community kind of gets these people through. That the two don't in their equation include organizing or solutions is for me not a condemnation of them or even, for me, a marginalization of those works, but maybe a reminder that you need to see some of those stories told in other films, that, you know, we get so few representations of this. It's not a problem of the individual film, but what's out there in the spectrum.
Well, I'd still argue that it's part of the red-baiting culture, that the communist, the revolutionary, is not accepted in the story, because in any story, I mean, let's look at Tremé, a film I love. I mean, a series that I love. So, you know, you have the white disc jockey and you have the white criminal lawyer who's trying to track down a specific case. You have people from Ray Nagin's office. You have every musician under the sun is coming in there. What I'm arguing about is, I've been in the black community for 50 years. I can't imagine a film about any black neighborhood that does not have the black militant in it. So it's not like it's a different film. It's a clear exclusion in my opinion, because it's almost like David, and I'm thinking this out loud, that David Simon is a great guy from everything I know. But what if he says, I am the furthest left that this show can go, and I don't want to cast any characters that will ruin the fact that I know where the show is supposed to go, and I could have chosen to find some community organizer. I know that they exist, but in both shows he doesn't. And I think that's the cycle of the movement, which is, we're not strong enough to just demand to be in these films. we could use a break. The break would be just casting somebody in a favorable light. We're not going to get that break, which helps the, hurts the movement. But at some point, I think we're going to have that struggle with politically creative people that think they're progressive. Because as I'm listening to it, I think we're being written out of history, and I think it's pretty conscious.
I think more of those films need to be made. I don't know if those things need to be worked into people that already have an existing point of view. I think your argument is more relevant probably with network television, which, you know, to meet a market needs to be representative. I also think there's more organizing opportunities because networks have felt accountable. They have with the percentage they have of gay and lesbian characters, and, you know, they're getting a lot of pressure from NAACP for more diversity. Doesn't work. It's nowhere near what it could be. I think David Simon and Martin Scorsese have a single vision, and they're going with it. And for me, that's the point of film or a cable TV show. David Simon's films are not about like the spectrum of everything going on in the city, but about the failure of institutions or the failure of people to connect. Or in the case of Tremé, his solution is not community organizers. His solution is community, is people have each other and connection. I don't think in either case is the exclusion conscious. I might argue that again with network television and maybe more mainstream film it is, or it's ignorant. But I think those shows and that film, one that I like more than the other. I like the David Simon films more than the Scorsese film. Both of those don't come from seeking to keep something out or a conscious vision, but a desire to go in one direction, focus on it, and really commit to it. And I think to a degree they succeed.
Well, the great thing about being the host is I get the last word on this round. Let me just try one more time. Mm-hmm. That one of the problems that I've been since I've been organizing in L.A. is people keep saying to me, why aren't you going to Hollywood to raise money? This one's progressive. That one's progressive. And then I say, well, we're working in South L.A., mainly around Crenshaw and Slauson. Then we're in East L.A. We're in Pico Union. We're organizing poor people. We're organizing working people. We're taking on the MTA. We're fighting for first-class bus system. We're trying to get young people out of prison. We're trying to stop the school of prison pipeline. We're trying to take on the corporate interests that run Los Angeles. Could you talk about, I need something more clear, like water. Tell me about water. Or tell me about, I need a cause. I need one thing that I can grasp that Harry Belafonte would laugh at them. Harry Belafonte, he organized hundreds and hundreds of professional musicians, of course, overwhelmingly black, but Pete Seeger and Theodore Bacall and people who said, I do get the politics of this. I want to integrate politics. Joan Baez, obviously, Bob Dylan at the time, the late Richie Havens. I went up to Richie Havens in Philly, and I didn't know who he was. I thought he was pretty great. So this was before he was anything. And I said, hey, Richie, I'm with the Congress of Racial Equality. Would you like to work with us? He says, I love CORE. Yeah, this is great, man. I'd love to. So we had access back then. The person's consciousness was there was a movement, and the artist wanted to hang around with the movement. So I think the bigger problem is, how are we going to knock down the doors of Hollywood beyond their own level of cultural comfort? I said I wanted to get the last word in, but Gary wants to go another couple of rounds. So let's do it.
I don't want to go a couple of rounds on, you know, whether we like The Wolf of Wall Street, but I think you brought up something that I have a strong reaction to. And I think it is, I'm not advocating an ahistorical approach, but I think history and perhaps nostalgia can stymie or kill us. And I see that happening with a lot of progressive groups. Saying that Harry Belafonte would have laughed, or we had it this way, or we had it that way, that's something to use as an inspiration to say it was once possible, what worked then will work, what worked then might work now. I think the question that brings up is, what are progressive groups doing to engage the entertainment industry? And are they being smart enough? Are they working hard enough? Are they trying to figure out how to get the 2013 version of that rather than lamenting the absence of it? I see a lot of lost opportunities. I've seen recently Los Angeles Alliance for New Economy had Lucinda Williams open their dinner with John Densmore of the Doors, opening with a Bruce Springsteen song called Factory, Merle Haggard's If We Make It Through December, and a song of hers called Born to Be Loved that made a political statement because they took the work to engage with the entertainment industry. Liberty Hill does the same thing, and it's not from lamenting the past. It's saying we have to work harder, we have to be smarter, and we have to organize people the same way we do. The same way we organize neighborhood residents, so do we need to organize Hollywood, so do we need to organize entertainment and the arts. And I have seen a lot of people, in especially those two organizations, Los Angeles Alliance for New Economy and Liberty Hill, I've seen them reach out to people and get them excited, and those people get their friends. And that's how it happened back then.
Well, I think where we see it differently is that you call it nostalgia and I call it history. I mean, this is an ahistorical consciousness that people have. If you are not reading Malcolm X, if you're not reading Martin Luther King, if you're not reading the history of what happened in 1964, all that work I bring to bear on the present. But when I have a very bad experience with a lot of people from Hollywood, because it's not like we haven't tried, I think about, well, what was different? And there's a couple of things that were different. I think in certain periods, there are ideas in the air. You know, the ideas shape a whole generation by a certain number of things. So I was very, very fortunate. I grew up in a period where I was being radicalized, very radicalized, but rapidly. People would be one place. 6 months later, they'd be in a, you know, people would be married. Next thing they know, they'd be in a women's collective, and then their marriage. People would be Wall Street lawyers. I would go out to a Wall Street lawyer, really, and tell him, I'd like you to give me money, but fundamentally, what are you doing on Wall Street? You need to join the movement. And 3 months later, he calls me up and says, I took your advice. I quit. People gave up. People went to organize in the Army. People went to Leavenworth, Kansas. The reason I'm saying that is because Hollywood produces what it wants and is a product of what it wants. So I think even the celebrities that we've been able to get, when I listen to them, it's generally an uninformed celebrity. It's a self-congratulatory celebrity. It's a person that believes more than me that they know where society goes. They're not saying, you know, I am really, really great at my craft, but I don't know a damn thing about social change. Could you help me? But no, the speeches they give are all about themselves. And, you know, or this group is really great. And sometimes when they say what's great about the group, they're saying it in a way to defang it. They're saying it in a way to make it more moderate, to make it more acceptable in their own eyes, because their agent has told them, you don't want to hang around with anything militant. So tonight, we're going to soften the message because you have to stay on message. Now, there are exceptions. In every historical period, there are exceptions. You know, Chuck D is a very important historical figure. You know, the later Mary Baraka. We're looking for politically conscious actors, writers, directors who have an edge, who understand what's really, really wrong with the society. So I use Harry Belafonte as an example because we need more Harry Belafontes. And if you're out there, the speech that Harry Belafonte gave at the SNCC reunion was mind-blowing about the state of the world, the state of the black community, the limits of the Obama administration, the economic crisis, the massive police and surveillance state. He didn't miss a word. It's like I couldn't believe it. Every sentence was perfectly constructed at 83. So he was challenging SNCC on our 50th anniversary. We got to get back into the streets. The revolution is far from over. So I would say that, and now I do want to move on, mm-hmm. is that we have to challenge people in Hollywood to say that you don't set the standard for giving. You have to listen and learn from some of the people, and you may be born into some areas of discomfort that I think will be great for you. Now, is that an easy sell? No, no.
But that takes playing with the puzzle, and that takes being smart. I'm not advocating a historical. I'm saying you want the best of the past. You want to figure out what do we do then that works, what do we do then that doesn't work, and get the next Harry Belafonte, get more people like Steve Earle and Tom Morello, or Macklemore and Lewis doing what they did in the Grammys, a radical act arguing for marriage equality, more radical than or as radical as anything we've talked about here that came from Pete Seeger or Phil Oakes, looking for those opportunities. Educating people without coddling them, and getting smart ourselves about what in 2014 works.
We don't disagree. And Gary, you know, we're looking to you to find all those Hollywood revolutionaries. So we're talking about art, politics, and film, and the role of politically conscious filmmakers. Let's go to John Sayles, because you had some very interesting analysis of his career, his phases. John Sayles, for a lot of our listeners know and some don't, is among the most politically conscious, because every film he makes, he wants to tell a particular story to make a particular point. So some make it better than others, but that's his point. He has long since lost being able to finance the films. He works in the industry to get money as a film editor and other things. And he produced this film. The last one was Go Four Sisters, which I happen to like a lot. But Gary, tell me how you understand John Sayles, some of the best films, and you are critical of his present period.
Let's not focus too much on the negative, because I think his body of work, you think he's one of the great American filmmakers, and I know it's radical to say so, but I'd equate him with Coppola and Scorsese if you look at, that the first 20 years and work hopefully to come. There's a certain kind of film he makes that I love. I mean, I really love a film like Brother from Another Planet, or the film he made, Baby It's You with Rosanna Arquette, or The Secret of Roan Inish, which is a very atypical film for him, a very kind of lyrical, poetic film. But the films I like are his films he makes about cities in transition. And I think he started it with City of Hope, which is sort of like The Wire before The Wire. The best example is most people know Lone Star from the late 90s, about a Texas border town. Lesser known is a film called Limbo about Alaska, and Sunshine State about a small town in Florida. And they're all about, again, that struggle between the nostalgia of the past, the lessons of the past, the different factions, race, class, immigration, but not in a didactic way. And even from John Sayles, who's a very left-wing filmmaker, he's never trying to say everything that happens now is bad or negative. Even in a film like Sunshine State, he questions whether the role of history is excessive, whether the commemoration of something is even true, or whether it's false nostalgia. At the same time, taking a look at the emptiness of not remembering the past, and looking at sort of the interlocking world of so many characters in so many communities. Hard to summarize.
No, that's great, but putting it in the same words as Coppola and Scorsese, I think John Sayles would be very happy to hear that. So, folks, 818-985-5735, now you have come to the phone. Debbie, talk to us about film, art, and hopefully a film you saw this year that you like, that you want us to know about.
Ooh, I am not, big film buff. I preferred more of the smaller films personally, but I have a general comment on I haven't seen any of the movies you guys were talking about, the other guy said to you that why are you lamenting the past or something to that effect when you spoke about Belafonte and them all, and my thing is that's what makes Shakespeare and Moliere timeless, is that they commented on the politics of their days, on everything that was going on simultaneously. Life is not just one area, that you just specialize like Scorsese and all. Life is multidimensional, and everybody's truth has to be represented, not just one person's point of view.
Thanks so much, Debbie. Really great to hear from you. We're going to go to Kanek, if that's the right name.
Yes, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. My name is Kanek, and I didn't necessarily have a film or that I wanted to share about, but just a comment about the general topic. The role of artists and celebrities in supporting the movement, you know, I just kind of feel that a lot of celebrity artists, you know, they hold a position of privilege in our society as far as having social capital and in many cases financial capital. And I think that a lot of times when folks find themselves in a position of privilege, they need to step back and listen to what other folks have to say who don't have that privilege in the movement, you know. And so, you know, the Zapatistas from Mexico, they have a saying of mandar obedeciendo, you know, to lead by obeying and lead by obeying the people. And I think, you know, there's some artists that have taken that to heart, too, and have kind of changed it up to say, in some cases, like for visual artists, pintar obedeciendo, to paint obeying the people. And so I think that probably one of the best things that celebrity artists can do is to really learn to listen and learn to listen to people in the on the grassroots that are actively involved in the front lines of this movement.
Thank you so much. That was very, very helpful. I really appreciate that. Jake, let me see if I can get Jake and then Mark and then
Hello.
Bill.
Hello.
Could anybody please talk about some films? I'm sorry, if you're not going to mention the name of a film, I'm going to have to cut you off because that's what the call is about. A film you like this year that you want to comment on.
Yes, hello?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to Mark.
Hey, how you guys doing?
I don't know.
Pretty
tell
good.
Tell
hey,
me
Mark.
About a film you've seen.
Hey, I did see Gravity.
All right, tell us about that.
Hello?
So tell us about Gravity.
Yeah, it's okay to talk about Gravity?
Yeah.
If it was projected on a screen, we want to hear your opinion on it.
Gravity, made by a Latino film director, great film. But you know what gets me? Since we're talking about agendas and the political.
Wait. Stay aspect. On Gravity, folks. I need you to stay a little bit more on the film itself.
Well, regarding the film itself, I mean, the effects are great. The story was great. Sandra Bullock was great. I thought George Clooney's role was okay, you know, but aside from that, I mean, I think it's an awesome film, you know. I would rate it as one of the best that I've seen, you know, that's nominated for all the awards today.
Okay, you have 1 minute to make a political observation about art and politics.
Okay, well, regarding Gravity, if you think about the Latino film director, you know, he has a lot of opportunity there to establish a Latin character. And I'm not on, that's not my main point, but, you know, you come from a great, viewing his great work and the opportunity that he has. And when he has a chance, you know, little do you see regarding the effect he can have on his community, you know. And I think it's a great, you know, topic you guys have, so thank you.
Thank you. That's really wonderful. Who do we got? Tracy? Can we go to Tracy, please, up at the top of the board?
Yeah, I don't know that I've heard anyone talk about The Act of Killing today, but that was one of the films that was at the New Art in the last year, and it's up for a foreign Oscar nomination, and it's pretty phenomenal. It's about the Indonesian death squads, and it's sort of a documentary, but it's very artful. Does anyone know what I'm talking about?
I've seen it. I've seen it a couple times, and I think there are many great things about it. And it is not, it's a very political film, again, without just being about politics. It's about, one's personal connection to perpetuating a genocide or a high crime, and the role that empathy can play and the role that enabling can play as well.
What did you you saw it, and that's great. So tell us a little bit more about it. It sounds like is this about the Suharto period after Sukarno came out? Is this during the 60s and 70s when they wiped out a million communists or a million people that they thought were in a communist-led revolution? Is that the fundamental theme of that story?
It is, and what the filmmakers have done, which is pretty amazing, is that they've got some of the gangster thug death squad leaders who were involved to talk about and then reenact their crimes on camera.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you see the way they talk with an extreme impunity about it until they're kind of forced to confront it. It's about horror and opportunity.
And your name is Tracy?
Yeah.
Could you please call in more often?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for mentioning that. That might have been my number three film.
All right. I'm serious.
Yeah.
So we'd like to get, you know, some listeners with, so I have two more. Just say the names of two other films you liked, and I'm going to still go back to the board.
You want to know more films I like?
Just two with no elaboration.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have kind of a funky connection. I was going to mention one other film, which was The Hunt, which is up for an Oscar nomination for foreign, I think I was going to say Belgian, but I don't think that's right. It's Scandinavian. And it's about a man who's falsely accused of sexually molesting a girl, and about a witch hunt that ensues in the aftermath of that and how it transforms their community.
Thank you so much. Lloyd, can we get you?
Yeah.
Tell us about a film, Lloyd, a real film.
I saw Her last night.
Okay, great.
And I thought it really had a lot to say, you know, commenting a lot on our society and where it could potentially be going. And, you know, this guy falls in love with his operating system, and it's sort of like in the world of this movie, that's something that's kind of happening at that time, you know, and people are talking about it. I mean, you almost expect there to be a support group for it. And,
right.
I don't know, but it said a lot about, you know, how we are becoming more isolated because of technology. And, yeah, it was really interesting.
In terms of the theme of narcissism, the idea that he at first fell in love with his operating system because she told him everything that she wanted to hear, and then he goes and he has dinner with his gorgeous wife, who helped him through his playwriting and who has great kids with him, and he can't relate to her. Did that in any way move you as far as the film?
Yeah, I thought it was very sad, and I mean, I thought it said a lot about the wife, ex-wife character is saying that he can't, or, you know, she could never be what he seemed to want her to be. And yet they had lived through a lot together and had a lot of experiences together. And, yeah, I thought showing his isolation and, you know, it's like he won't allow himself to completely love her. It's like the idea that there's always something, you know, better, more perfect out there for us.
That was really great. Thank you so much. That's a very... It's a very nice line, the belief that there's always something perfect out there for us. Okay, I'm very sorry you guys came in late, but now this is fun. I'm going to take Lim, and this will be, unfortunately, our last call. We'll do it again. We're going to do a lot of stuff on films. Lim, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Okay, what's the film you want our listeners to know about?
Fruitvale Station, the Oscar Grant story.
Absolutely. Why is not on my list? Up there were the two or three best. Why did Michael B. Jackson not get an Oscar?
I think because it came out in the summer. I think, you know, usually anything that comes up before August gets forgotten, with the exception of Blue Jasmine.
Call back on the next show. They're getting rid of us now. Thank you for bringing in Fruitvale Station, which was in the list in my head, but wasn't the list in my paper. Our dear, dear listeners to KPFK and Voices from the Frontlines, you guys are really great. You know, we do the show for you. You stay on message most of the time. You bring new ideas to the show. We just love you a lot. Now, next week is the fun drive. I'm going to try to be doing the fun drive next Tuesday. And if I do, then Voices listeners, let's kick off the fun drive by giving a big support to KPFK. I want to thank Gary Stewart, my friend and comrade and colleague and conspirator, for being on the show. I want to thank G for being the force behind the window. and Crystal McMillan for being the producer. Good night, everybody. Little darling.